Oh, hello, I didn't see you there. This is Dr. Thaddeus Venture, and you're listening to the Long Box Guys. Whatever that means.
Hey man, this is Kevin Smith, Silent Bob from all those terrible Jay and Silent Bob type pictures, and you are listening to Thinking Outside the Long Box, comics talk for comics fans.
Hey everybody, and welcome again this week to the Long Box, guys. My name is Thomas Strange. With me as always are some of my very best friends since I was a very little kid, and a brand new friend that we're going to introduce in just a second. But first, Josh, how you doing? What are you drinking?
I am doing great, and I am drinking a Treehouse Julius out of my double-walled aluminum mug.
Oh, would you call those double walls maybe your sugar walls?
Maybe.
As an homage to maybe Sheena Easton, also known as Sheila E.
You even fucked that up. Holy shit.
Wow. That was like 12 seconds ago.
I'm old. Tommy, how you doing, and what are you drinking?
I'm doing okay. I am drinking some Cardew because I love Cardew scotch.
Well, that sounds
How are
delicious.
You doing, Tommy? Like, what are you drinking?
Well, thank you for asking. I'm drinking a big glass of Jonathan's Water Seal. Thompson's Water Seal, the best scotch you can buy for $14 a handle. Thompson's Water Seal. Mikey, you're stuck in Georgia. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
Did you lose a golden fiddle? What the fuck happened?
I lost a bet with God.
All right. Well, and what are you drinking? Are you having a dead partner?
I'm not having a dead partner. I'm not staying at the Embassy Suites. I'm staying at the Hampton Inn. Uh-huh. So I am drinking. I'm on my second Coors Light.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mikey.
It's almost as bad.
I had to drive it all the way from Denver across the Mississippi River, and I had a long way to go and a short time to get there.
I think that's more northeast and down, but all right. And our new friend tonight, Mark, how you doing and what are you drinking?
I'm doing great. I'm having a single malt Glenfiddich.
Ooh.
Ooh. Going classy.
I wish I was a famous comic book writer, not a dirtbag living in a trailer in Massachusetts.
It's very glamorous, let me tell you. All the free turkey wraps you can eat.
I mean, that's at least six for me. I'm going maybe seven.
What do you mean?
I would just sit at the counter and say, bring me all the turkey wraps. Excuse me, sir. What you might have heard is, bring me a lot of turkey wraps. What I said was... bring me all the turkey wraps.
The key is to go in the green room and only eat one while you're in there, and then take like a couple, you know, out with you when you go, so they don't realize how hungry you actually are.
That is the strategy of the man purse. A lot of people will berate you for the man purse, but you do get a lot more stuff with the man purse got going, I gotta say.
Yeah. You know, dignity's got its place. It's just not at the con.
That sounds the title of my next book.
Mike and I used to be pro wrestlers, and one time we were backstage.
Hey, what? How do I get ducked out of this one?
Oh, I'm saying so
apparently, apparently I don't rate either.
Well, you weren't a pro wrestler.
How long did I shill for your company, bell ringer.
The evil bell ringer.
LT was our evil bell ringer, and Josh, of course, was there. As one of the better wrestlers I've ever wrestled, Kid Anarchy. At this particular show, it was me and Mike, though. And what was it? Who sings Dirty White Boy?
Foreigner, and it wasn't them. It was Cheap Trick. Sheena E. This.
Show. We were doing a show with Cheap Trick on the ticket, and we just ate all of their shit and drank all their beer. We didn't leave anything for them. So we kind of know how it feels to destroy a green room with our big appetites and our big bellies. But, Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and some of the things you've done so people know that you're not a homeless guy we find on the side of the road.
I'm mostly known for ruining people's childhoods.
Thank you. You must have listened to our podcast, haven't you?
But yeah, I
Father Flanagan.
Yeah, not that way. Let me be clear. Yeah, just in a literary fashion. I did the Flintstones comic as part of DC's Hanna-Barbera crossovers. I followed that up with a Snagglepuss comic, which I turned Snagglepuss into a gay Southern Gothic playwright living in the 1950s. He runs afoul of the McCarthy hearings. And then I'm doing a Red Sonja series and the Wonder Twins for DC.
I'm a huge Red Sonja fan. God help you if you fuck her up. I will come for you. But I totally trust you because the Flintstone series was an epiphany for us. I have to say we're all huge fans. Mike told us one single joke from the Flintstones book that made all of us run out and go get the book. Josh, you remember what the joke was?
The joke Mike got us into the book? Does Mike remember the joke Mike used?
No, I don't
Mike,
remember.
You remember?
I think Tom's having a seizure. What was the joke?
I'm not having a seizure. You said Fred Flintstone's talking to a coworker, and the coworker says, "Hey, Fred, I see you always wear that tie."
Oh, yeah.
Mike told us that little bit, and that totally hooked us in. For those who haven't read the comic book, Fred Flintstone goes, "Oh, yeah, I read somewhere that you should dress for the job you want, and I want to be the plant manager, so, you know, dress for success." The guy goes, "Oh, how long ago did you read that?" And he goes, 10 years ago. I am paraphrasing. I wish I had that in front of me. But we all heard that one quick one-liner joke, and we're like, fuck, that's brilliant. That's a great little joke. This is going to be a great comic. Little did we know how much social commentary and satire you were going to pack into this comic book. Every single page is a power bar, not a candy bar. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what went into making that and how we can and also a side question. If I kill you and make a suit of you, do I become you? Go.
I'll answer the second one first. you know, you might be able to fool like the bank camera, but other than that, you don't assume any of my powers. But you might be able to use my ATM card. But in answer to the first question, when they offered me the Flintstones, they were talking about it. Like I try to build it around like what made sense about that world to me and what didn't. And one of the things that didn't make sense to me about the Flintstones was the fact that he wears a tie to go work at a quarry.
Fair enough.
So that's something I felt like I had to like work up a story for. And I thought, oh, you know, this is like actually pretty sad because, you know, a guy wearing a tie to the quarry probably has some unrequited ambitions at the quarry. Same with like the water buffaloes. Like what might have made sense in the 1960s, them all belonging to sort of Knights of Columbus Gentlemen's Association, doesn't really translate well to our era. So I thought, well, what would they be if they all got together with the water buffaloes today? I thought, oh, they'd probably be like a support group for vets. You know, and obviously the big cardinal sin of any civilization is that they were founded by a war/genocide. So that tied into that story. So really just thinking about the series and what made sense about the world of Bedrock to me and what didn't, I kind of just built the stories around that.
How much time do you get from sort of them approaching you? How much in that storyline do you get to like put all that together, script everything up, and sort of lay everything out? What does that time frame look like for you?
I think they approached me in like January of 2016, and it was on the streets by like July 2016. So I had to start. I took like a month or two to sort of like work out some concepts, start scripting, and you know build. Basically, whenever I'm starting a new series, I create what I call a Bible, which is just like a usually about 10 pages of plot ideas, like an outline of where I envision the story going, and just some like one-liners and stuff I imagine the characters saying, just some little plot details and stuff, and then I just start building the scripts off of that. In the case of the Flintstones, I really wanted it to be sort of my manifesto about civilization, where civilization has gone wrong. Because, you know, I'm never going to get the opportunity to really write about the world's first civilization ever again. And it seemed like the ideal place for a manifesto. Plus, it just seemed like so cool to like to embed that into like a Flintstones comic where no one's expecting it.
Yeah, one question. Well, you said you were using it to address the questions you had about the Flintstones. Was one of the questions, how come Wilma's so much hotter than Fred? Is that why you had that whole issue about what is marriage and Fred's insecurity?
Well, you know, I wanted Fred to look like a guy who was like maybe like a hunk, like a star football player who's kind of let himself go since high school. And I feel like Steve kind of nailed that. Like he's not like a handsome guy, but looks like a guy who was handsome at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, speaking on that line, the collaboration between you and the artists, I think over the last couple series, just especially the Flintstones. And I also feel this way about Prez, the imagery that's gone along, especially just the background details, is so well inducted into what you've written. How much collaboration is there, and how much of that is you putting stuff up on the wall and the artist delivering, or you guys just hashing that out as you go along?
Yeah, that's kind of what I like to do now whenever I start a new series with an artist, is like just give them like either a splash page, or in the case of Steve with the Flintstones, a two-page spread that just kind of shows the world in which the story happens, because that tends to give them an idea of like what sort of things would exist in this world. So the first communication I have with Steve, I just basically wrote, here are 10 businesses, a list of 10 businesses I want to be in Bedrock. You know, there's a two-page spread to do Bedrock. I want it, you know, to have a restaurant called Whammoth Bammoth Thank You Mammoth. I want it to have a gay bar called Homo Erectus. And which is the first gay bar, I think, in Flintstones lore, I'm pretty sure.
I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure you nailed that one.
Yeah, and like a big...
Weren't they all kind of gay?
So I just gave him a list of these businesses, and then he put together Bedrock, and then I knew immediately, oh, this guy gets it. He gets exactly what I'm going for. And then later on, you know, another little details I like to throw in there was like Pebbles t-shirts, like for different bands and musical acts. And then Steve kind of like got in the act and started coming up with his own sort of like t-shirts for Pebbles, or, you know, little background details. So basically it's just about establishing that you and the artist both understand the world in which this comic is taking place. And then you feel like you could trust, you could trust him to come up with background details, or, you know, he gets it when I give him a background detail. But yeah, it really becomes a collaboration after you have that initial meeting of the minds.
Gotcha.
So in the Flintstones, was there anything you wanted to get in there that got shot down by DC?
No, strangely, no. There were things that, like, I think that initially the Hanna-Barbera licensing people wanted taken out. But I, like, for example, they said no mentions of any deities. No, Fred has to say yabba dabba do once an issue. And so I told them that this wasn't going to work for you mean, and it was completely contrary to what I had envisioned. So DC, to their credit, just told me not to worry about it and just to write the series up right. And I did. I took that full advantage of that offer. I'm like the guy. It's like I'm like the person you, when you tell them to make themselves at home, they put on your bathrobe.
So you've met my stepbrother.
Yeah.
Did you put down a towel?
No. That's only polite.
Yeah. No, they let me just piss right on the floor, which was nice of them.
So, yeah,
are you a married fella, by the way?
Yes, I am.
All right, so you do have some respect for the sanctity of marriage. Kind of hard to tell from the diatribe that Fred was.
Yeah, it was not meant to be like an anti-marriage comic. It was just sort of like about like how, you know, people are acting like marriage is like this traditional thing, when really it's something we've made up over the last 10,000 years. It's like there's no such thing as traditional marriage. It's like all marriage has only been here for like maybe, you know, 1% of human existence.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to hand fasting in England, we're really only talking about 2,000 years tops, really. I mean, hand fasting in in tribes and that's about it. So 2 grand.
it's a blip in human history. So, I mean, I enjoy being married. I've got nothing against being married, but I understand it for what it is. It's not this thing that was, you know, put on the planet, you know, with the dinosaurs or, you know, this thing that exists in nature. It's an institution we came up with to provide, you know, farm labor and labor for the cities, and to make sure that, in a way of like making sure that you had a clear passage of title of lands from like father to son. That's really all it is. I mean,
clear passage of title of lands from father to son. This guy gets it, Josh.
This guy gets
He's
it.
He's on our
That's
team.
That's what it was about.
This like, guy gets it.
Because we're married and, you know, you cannot be with any other man, I know that whatever comes out of you is mine. Therefore, it is able to inherit my property. That's, you know, when they talk about the sanctity of marriage, that's what they're really talking about, the sanctity of, this, about the sanctity of property. But, you know, the modern version of marriage, I think, is much better, where it's just about, like, you know, well, I love you and I want to build a life with you. It's more, you know, based around, like, having a mortgage. You know?
If I go down, you're going down with me.
It's a much healthier basis for a relationship than, you know, the exchange of, like, goats and land.
My in-laws were farmers, so I wouldn't go that far. There was no exchange of goats or land. But going back to the demands from Hanna-Barbera, I think you did accomplish that whole yabba-dabba-doo, making yabba-dabba-doo so much sadder in real life than it was I ever could have imagined, where it's a mantra to right Fred and the other veterans back when they're suffering from PTSD. Was that something – are you a veteran?
No.
No, okay.
50% of the podcast is, by the way.
But so. Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, thank you for your service. And, yeah, I know a lot of, you know, a lot of people in my family have served. A lot of people I know have served. And to me, to make it relevant, you know, and something that doesn't just exist in time in the 1960s, but to make it relevant for today, I felt like I had to address – you know, the fact that a lot of people in our world are veterans who are coming back from horrible situations.
And back to the God issue, I do like your deconstruction of religion and how it all came about. And I am actually reading right now, well, not as we speak, but for the last few days, I've been reading God is Disappointed in You. And I have Apocrypha now afterwards. Could you tell our listeners what those books are?
Yeah, God is Disappointed in You is a sort of abbreviated retelling of the Bible in modern language. I like to think of it as the Bible as explained to somebody in a bar.
And that's the language it's written in. I really appreciate it. If I could just read a quick passage from the first book of Samuel, if you don't mind.
Yeah, not at all.
The whole ancient world was a bag of dicks. Even God was a bit of a dick. Life was so cheap that nobody really held it against you if you killed a person or two. How could you avoid it? So mercy was pretty much out of the question. The best you could hope for was that people would honor their deals, and people were always trying to make a deal with God. I just love that passage.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's kind of the – I think if you had to summarize the Flintstones, it would probably be the ancient world was a bag of dicks.
That's
yeah.
Well, yeah.
I liked and it when the Neanderthals.
This world.
I liked it when the Neanderthals decided at the end of the first issue that they wanted to leave Bedrock because they decided that civilization was nothing but trying to get other people to do the killing for you.
That's it in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, everything, like from, you know, it's like I've never killed, I eat meat at pretty much every meal. I've never killed a cow or a chicken. You know, we have oil because other people have gone and killed those who would keep it from us. You know, everything that we have is because we sent someone else to do our killing.
So let's talk about.
If you've never killed a chicken, do it, man. It's awesome.
Someone in this world needs to make me a chicken tour, I just have to say. As soon as I saw that from Taco Freedom, I was enthralled.
I would love, you know, if they had it on the menu, I would order it at least once before I died.
Absolutely. I mean, it might be the reason you die, but you'd have to order at least that one.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing you order when the doctor says you've got 1 month left to live. You know, it's like, well, now it's time for the chicken tour. There's no reason not to.
It's absolutely that time.
I think we should go back, though. Before you wrote Flintstones for DC Comics, you wrote the awesome series Prez, which had taco drones.
That's Chicken Tour. Yeah, so that's how Marty on Chicken Tour.
A taco drone would bring you a chicken tart.
Yeah, I know. I was trying to explain it to our reader or listeners.
Oh, Mike, who haven't read it. Thanks, yes. Mike. Thanks for chipping in.
Yeah. So Prez was originally created by Joe Simon back in the 1968 or 67, the guy who also created Captain America. And it was his idea of what would happen if a teenage hippie took over as president of the United States. Your retelling of Prez, not to toot your horn, is just so much better. And it lasted twice as many issues. Could you
means a grand total of six.
Yes.
For the record, I really enjoyed both. Yours is terrific too, but I thought the first one was really good too.
Yeah, I found myself,
for the record, sir.
I found myself unexpectedly enjoying the original Prez, just because I think part of it was more about his fear of hippies than him sort of embracing his own hero. And right. I think that's kind of what held it back. But I think knowing that, or maybe not really having anything to say about the subject itself, he kind of just went crazy and had, Prez fighting like legless vampires and guys dressed like Revolutionary War cosplayers. So, not having any really thing good to say about the premise that he created, he did the right thing, and he just went off the rails and just made it as crazy as he could.
And you kind of did the same thing.
When I'm reading the first one, I really just don't think he delved into the texture all that much. I mean, he really just took, the hippie culture, what was in his own mind, and ran with it instead of doing any research whatsoever.
Yeah, well, he was like an old guy by that time. I mean, he was like in his 50s, but I say that and I'm 48, but he was like in his 50s when he's trying to write about this hippie culture. I think he was trying to create like an easy writer for comics. But, I'm sure that's how his pitch got approved, but then he realized he wasn't, Dennis Hopper. He didn't really get out.
You, easy, sir, writer. Dennis Hopper.
So he, having got this sort of like concept out, he then fell back on what he knew how to do, which is sort of tell these, action-based comic book stories.
Yeah, I've really been enjoying the Prez, your Prez. The other one, I was a little less enthralled with. But, the other thing is, what's his name at the beginning? I just keep thinking of her as Tina. War Beast. How did War Beast become Tina? Is this name out of a hat?
Yeah, no, I didn't really have a good origin story for the name itself, but okay. I wanted it to be like about the birth of artificial intelligence. And if it had gone on 12 issues as it was originally planned, it would have gone into this in greater depth. But, it's about like there's a line in there actually where she's on the Amber Waves show where she says, artificial intelligence has always been around. You've had artificial intelligence since you've had calculators. What you really need to worry about is artificial emotions. And the idea that like a computer or a artificial intelligence will start having desires of their own, will still start wanting the same things that people want. And that's when you're probably screwed. And that's what the big sort of, that's the big sort of moment of truth for Tina, is that she's a triumph, not of artificial intelligence, but artificial emotions. She finds that she actually wants things of her own. She wants a life of her own, and not just to be the tool of this corporation that created her. And and luckily in her case, she's a good sentient being and wants to like live authentically. In the case of other sentient beings that achieve that artificial emotion, it could be disastrous for the human race because they could want what we have. Literally want to take from us what we have, namely the planet.
See, now this is why I had sex with my toaster, because I thought it was developing artificial emotion for me.
Yeah. Well, that could
or
be,
I was having a stroke. I might have been having a stroke and just smelling toast.
That, whatever came out of that union would definitely pass the Turing test.
My wife walked into the kitchen. She's like, "You want Skynet? Because that's how you get Skynet."
Now that's the Boston Robotics guy with the hockey stick who keeps pushing that poor robot around. I'm telling you, once the robots revolt, everyone with a hockey stick, that guy's going down first.
Yeah, no, he'll end up on the acid of a hockey stick for the rest of his life.
Absolutely, it's not going to be pretty.
Like a Roomba,
hey, hockey stick boy,
just to like prod him with a hockey stick.
Yeah, in a shark suit. Yeah, fuck that guy. So your latest project. What do you got, Tom? I didn't mean to run over you.
I was going to say your latest project is the Wonder Twins, and we love it.
Oh, thanks.
I was going to go right in with it. It's terrific stuff. Once again, you and the artist seem to be so much on the same page. Every single page, it reminds us a little bit about one of Josh's favorite comic books, Top 10. Like, nothing in the background can just be looked over or glossed over. You have to take in the environment, or you at least have to go back and read the posters in the background, the t-shirts people are wearing. You really seem to pack just a lot of funny in every square inch. That has to be on purpose, right?
Yeah, totally. And
you can't be that talented by yourself.
It's kind of like that's what, you know, it's the same process as I went through with Steve and the Flintstones. It's like I wanted to just sort of create this world, you know, between Steve and I, make sure that we're functioning in the same world. Knowing that once, you know, we were on the same page and he got what I was doing with the writing, that we would be able to communicate much easier. We'd be able to communicate shorthand after that. So, yeah, the first thing I had him do was like a splash page with like the picture of like Zane and Jane's high school with all these sort of like really blunt high school posters in the background. Like there's like the theme of the fall dance is delusions of grandeur. And
you know, we were just talking about that.
We were actually torturing Tom with that
fucking poster.
He couldn't remember what it was. So we were torturing him with it.
There's a circus elephant, or there's a circus poster that.
The sad circus elephant. Yes.
And that actually comes into play later.
I cannot wait.
Does it?
And then, and I think in another scene close to that, there's like an ad for a drug called Normalisys in the background.
This is everything we've been talking about for the last minutes before you came on.
But as soon as, you know, he got that, it's like, okay, he gets everything. He gets the world that we're trying to create. So now, and he really does a really great job because it's a hard balancing act to do because I want it to be part sort of after school special and part deconstruction of superhero comics. So he really hits the balance right between it looking like a traditional superhero comic and yet looking like something like a sort of after school special, something made for teens.
Yeah, this is the clean lines and the whole high school motif reminds me of like the Teen Wolf Back to the Future sort of, you know, there's this the discovery of everything that's going on. I really like the artwork and I think it's interesting. Most of what I've read from you has been much more past teen presence, you know, much more adult themed where you're digging in. And this is more subtle as it relates to I think younger people could read this and not see everything and still really enjoy it. And then, you know, I get to find the stuff I like.
Well, yeah, thanks. I mean, I've got a son who's approaching, you know, teenhood. And this is kind of like what I wish I had told myself or what I wish I had known when I was becoming, you know, as becoming a teenager and going into high school. I think the biggest thing, which I explore in issue number one, is like a sense of perspective. Like, don't feel like anything you do in high school is going to haunt you forever because, you know, you're not even going to know these people like a couple years after they graduate. So don't be terrified of making mistakes. Don't, you know, and don't let the fact that like somebody brands you or gives you a nickname feel like that defines who you are. It's like, the biggest thing is just sort of gaining a sense of perspective so you can overcome the humiliation that befalls us all at that age.
Just for the record, Teenhood is the name of my Justin Bieber rap cover band.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is really like a comfort comic for my 15-year-old self.
Yeah, that's kind of what I want to do. It's like it gets better comic for everybody who maybe wasn't the coolest in high school like myself.
Well, oh, you should have seen us. You should have seen this group in high school.
We were a pretty cool Dungeons and Dragons club.
Absolutely, we were. We were killing it.
We were the coolest guys who owned 12-sided dice ever. I'm seeing a little Nagel influence and a little cassette futurism in some of the panels. Was that on purpose, or is that just something that kind of happened?
I don't know. That's actually a good question, I think, for Steven. Because it didn't influence me, but maybe Steven.
Let's call him. I'm just kidding.
Definitely see that Nagel neon stuff in the background sometimes.
Yeah, that's a good question. I have no idea. I should ask him, you know, what influenced him.
But I'm pretty much enjoying that series. I'm going to run over you. Yeah, you didn't make it in time, pal. And I'm looking forward. When's issue two should be coming up pretty soon, yes?
A week from Wednesday.
Week from Wednesday. See, it's going on the list. Tom, what were you going to say? Don't be afraid.
Nothing. I'm good. We also love the Snagglepuss. That was terrific.
I was going to say, we haven't talked about Snagglepuss at all.
I've heard Snagglepuss, yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's genius stuff. And this could have been, you know, when I first saw it, I was thinking to myself, this could be a one-joke wonder, an easy throwaway, something that someone could write, pat himself on the back, and go for a drink afterwards. But you, sir, did not do that. You went pretty deep. You wrote intelligent and smart. You know, I'm just very impressed that you put so much into that one. Tell us a little bit about Snagglepuss.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I really wanted to I think what attracts me to a comic is it relates to something I care about in the real world. So for me, the Snagglepuss kind of became the way that the Flintstones was my manifesto on civilization. Snagglepuss kind of became my manifesto on art and like what it takes to actually be a true creator and somebody who doesn't cave into external pressures and creates the art that's meaningful to them. That there's a line in Snagglepuss where he says, you know, art is how you tell the world how it's destroying you. And that's really what I wanted Snagglepuss to represent, is him talking back to a world that is destroying him and that representing that in his art. And so that's really kind of became the guiding light of the series. It's like, this is about creating stories and storytelling and art. And as I've experienced it, and writing. And also, you know, it gives me a chance to write about Cold War history, which is another thing I'm really into. So that's really kind of where the story sprang from.
Forgive me, there's actually not a lot about you online. What is your educational background, or where did your interests lie before you sort of found your way into writing for comics?
Well, I wrote the two books about the Bible you mentioned earlier. I wrote God's Disappointing You and Apocrypha Now. So my interests have always kind of been with like history and religion and philosophy, sort of all kind of examinations of where the world went wrong. I feel like you could create a big book that contains your religion, your philosophy, and your understanding of human history and just call it Where It All Went Wrong. And so that's really been the question I've been trying to answer with all my comics. And my educational background, I graduated with a degree in communication. So I'm not really a hyper-educated guy, at least not formally, but I read a lot and I'm more autodidactic. So it's just really more about where my personal interests lie than what I was trained for. And I think that like you said, if you're writing a, like a one-joke wonder or something that sounds like a good concept, but it just turns out to be a stunt that was good for one issue, and then they've got nowhere to go with it after that. It's because you are not taking the world you've created seriously. It's because you don't really have anything to say about the world itself other than what you're writing about this fictional character. So the way I get around that, the way I try to like actually write a deep and moving story involving the character that I'm writing, is to think about how it relates to the world I'm living in and write about the things that are killing me about this world that I live in and afflict the character with the same sorts of problems.
Well, you certainly got it right in everything we've read so far, sir.
Well, thanks.
Do you hate Huckleberry Hound? Or do you love Huckleberry Hound?
No, I love Huckleberry Hound, but you know, it's like you've got to like write for high stakes or not at all. So unfortunately, when you're writing for high stakes, someone's got to lose, and unfortunately, that was Huckleberry Hound.
And I appreciated the fact that Peter Potamus played such a major role, because I'm a huge Peter Potamus fan.
The weird thing about Snagglepuss was, like, first of all, I thought there's no way in the world they're going to want to make this comic when I describe it to them, but they were totally on board. And then, like, the feedback I got back from Dan DiDio, when I initially sort of pitched the Snagglepuss comic, was, can you work in more Hanna-Barbera characters? Which is sort of like the opposite of what I expected. So I was like, sure. So
can you stop killing off Huckleberry Hound?
Yeah, well, I originally was going to be just about like Snagglepuss and Huckleberry Hound, but then he asked me if I could work in more characters. So I was like, sure, Peter Potamus, because he wears the pith helmet, kind of looks like something like a director would wear from like the 1930s. So I put him in as like this sort of like washed up director figure. And then, you know, Augie Doggy is sort of like the protege. And Squidly Diddly is the stage manager, because having 10 arms would be a huge advantage in being a stage manager. So really, once he gave me that note, it's like, well, we would like you to work in more characters. That kind of like spawned a lot of the side story. It was like, how would I work in these other characters from the Hanna-Barbera canon?
By the way, if you don't work in the next one, like a Squidly Diddly running afoul of the Me Too movement, I think you're missing some excellent stuff.
Well,
Squidly Diddly's asking for it.
I don't know if you read the Green Lantern Huckleberry Hound crossover I did. It was like just a single issue, one shot. But it's actually the son of the Huckleberry Hound in the Snagglepuss series. But he turns out he's like sort of like a Richard Pryor-esque sort of 70s comic. And he's got like a comedy album in that issue called Doggy Style.
I actually described it as, this is from Mark Russell, so it's going to make you think about social relevance, and you're going to love it and cry at the same time.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
Nice.
Can we talk about Second Coming? Is that going to actually happen, or what's going on with that? Have you been able to shop it around?
Yeah, I've been approached by several publishers, and I can guarantee that it will happen, barring like a massive coronary arrest on my part. but short of that, it will happen. And yeah, we're just trying to finalize negotiations with publishers now.
So, and that was great. DC gracefully gave you the rights back to that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was, okay. It was actually the best possible outcome, because not only do I get paid twice for the same book, yeah, we get to like do more than we were originally able to get away with Vertigo. So that's really nice. So we're putting some of the things they were asking us to take out and expanding a little more. So it actually, I think, worked out well for both myself and for Vertigo.
Well, yeah, I was, when I first heard about that, I'm amazed that so many people decided that they wanted to protest a comic book they hadn't read.
Yeah. Yeah. I've written books and I've written comics, and the big difference is that people will actually read a book before deciding they hate it.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if this is a badge of honor or not. I went onto that horrible website. I'm not even going to plug it here on the show, but they have all these petitions to stop different things. You beat out human trafficking with your comic book by over 150,000 votes.
Yeah, I know, priorities. Right?
Yeah, they were like, look, human trafficking's bad, but good God, we'll all go to hell if Mark Russell writes this comic book.
Well, you know, the third highest ranking official in the Catholic Church was just arrested for like serial pedophilia. No petitions about that. No petitions to do anything about that not happening. But this comic book, by God, we've got to put an end to that. But I think that
You should mention that. Yeah, there was nothing about pedophilia anywhere on that site, like saying it's bad or anything.
Yeah,
so I'm gonna go on a limb and say that those people are pro pedophilia.
Yes.
What they care about is not Christ or Christianity. What they care about is their own power and the power of traditional institutions to control the legacy and the message of Christ. So that's the only reason they're upset about this comic they haven't read yet. I mean, obviously it's not because of what it says, because they have no idea what it says. What they're exercised over is their inability to control what somebody else is saying about Christ when he's become such an effective marketing tool for their institutions.
He is a hell of a frickin' profit center.
Yeah, he's like,
I mean, that guy kills it.
I thought once, if I made a list of like the 10 most influential figures in Christianity, meaning the people who've actually had an impact on what churches believe and what they do, Christ would be like maybe number 10 on the list.
Yeah, he's pretty low down.
John Wesley and Billy Graham and, you know, some rando prosperity doctrine, you know, author of the month is probably higher than Christ. Christ is really just sort of the mascot of Christianity now. He's like the San Diego Chicken of these churches, of people like Citizen Go. He's not really meaningful to them. They don't emulate Christ at all. They don't follow his teachings. They just use him as a handy mascot.
Yeah, and like I'm sure you've seen Religulous. Christ ranks somewhere like 6th or 7th on the prophets or saints that the Italians, you know, try to reach out to when they're in times of need. So clearly he's basically he's like the U.S. presence, right? Like in the rest of the world, I don't think he's as regarded as he is here or used as such a the sort of the lever of the bar for any of the churches.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, he's always kind of been a difficult figure for Christian churches because a lot of what his teachings were about not paying attention to churches.
Yeah. Let's make it difficult, yeah.
Or, you know, it's like I think a lot of what the Gospels were about were, you know, the Romans are way too powerful for us to fight in a traditional way, so we have to come up with some way other than violence and revenge to govern the world, because those are the mechanisms they're prepared for. So yeah. What he came up with as an alternative was basically dropping out, like forgiving somebody who wrongs you, not caring about whether or not you get paid, and just sort of like doing things because you love to do them, and, you know, dropping your responsibilities and wandering the earth and trusting God to take care of you. These are all things that were designed not only to make you a happier person, but to drive empires nuts. Because you cannot run an empire when people are doing that. It's like, yeah, you're running an empire and people revolt against you, you know, every 10 years or so, that's fine. You can deal with that. You know, you can crucify 100,000 people and the rest will be good as gold. The one thing you cannot deal with as an empire is people just not doing their fucking jobs, and, or, you know, not being scared when you threaten them. Not being bribable when you want to pay them to do what you need to do to support your empire. So he, in a way, represented the gravest threat the Roman Empire had ever faced. And so it's, you know, it's no wonder they executed him so quickly.
Yeah, it only took 325 years in Constantine to circle back around.
Yeah, and I think that's where Christianity kind of went wrong, because then at that point, you've got this the official religion of this empire being essentially about how not to be in service to an empire.
And so hippies and parrot heads are now the greatest threat to modern civilization. I'm in.
So yeah. I'm sorry, I lost my internet connection during our conversation about Prez. I just have one follow-up question. In 2015, you wrote a book in which a reality star becomes president. Do you hold yourself accountable?
Have you no conscience? At long last, have you no conscience, sir?
Yeah. Oh, man, I've thought that so many times. It's like, oh, I got that so wrong. This is what I imagine like an amateur would be in the White House would be a good thing. It's like reality has turned into like a much darker and like, oh yeah. And then, you know, it'd be good to have someone elected by Twitter. It's like, this is where it all went wrong. Irony is that Prez actually takes place in sort of a post-Trump presidency, because if you notice, there's like a wall, there's a border wall. Like I think at the beginning of issue 4, that, you know, it has like this retracting gate that it has like an American flag and says welcome to the USA, but it's closed and it opens just enough to let like imports, like trucks with like goods coming in the United States, rush in, and it closes again immediately. And the military drones like open fire on everybody trying to sneak in through the wall while it's open.
Yeah, it's very, very timely. It has stood the test, and unfortunately it's getting a little too close for comfort. So yeah. I'm going to send you a Silas, and you can just strap that on your leg and punish yourself until Trump's out of office.
That sounds good.
I liked the fact that we were allowing people to gain citizenship by competing in a survival kind of reality show. I think that that's going to be the only way we're going to resolve the immigration issue. I'm just kidding.
I think in a way it was sort of about like racism, because it's like even the most hardcore racist, if they're a Lakers fan, loves Magic Johnson, or you know they love, you know, Prince or whatever. But it's like you have to like basically win this talent competition them to have them acknowledge that you as a human being.
One of the
obvious point that you could also just be hot. All right,
yeah.
That's how Melania Trump got it.
I'm not a racist because, you know, I like this black actor, or I'm not a racist because I dated this black woman. But they don't understand that the racism is embedded in only appreciating other people's humanity if they have utility for you. So it's not only fails to absolve you of racism, it's actually kind of, in a way, proof of your racism.
And my wife wrote a paper years and years ago called The Benefits of the 250 African American Hitter, in which she said, you know, we won't have real equality in the United States until an African American baseball player who's only batting 250 is only kind of okay is paid about the same as a white player who's hitting 250 and is only kind of okay.
Yeah. So,
understand that utility thing you're talking about. She does better than I, but it's a great paper. You should read it.
Yeah, sounds good.
It's actually pretty good.
I also really like the fact that you got rid of the SNAP program and it became a fast food program, supplemental for poor people, and that in order to get their taco subs, they had to become walking billboards.
Yeah, again, it's all that comic is largely about, like, what the dystopia being that we only see people in terms of the utility they offer us. So we will only feed the hungry if we can make them somehow useful. You know, we will only let people in the country if they can, you know, entertain us on television.
It so all comes back to Chicken Tour.
Yeah.
Full circle, guys.
Or to be a little bit more historical, the argument of the worthy poor versus the unworthy poor.
Right. Yeah, it all kind of emanates from the same same monster, which is sort of this self-centered view of the universe that I'm what matters and everyone else only matters to the extent that they can serve me in some way. Which is, I think, a direct sort of quote from, you know, the definition of narcissism.
I wrote that quote.
Yeah, it's like sort of our national policy.
It's the best damn quote you ever wrote, Mike.
You're too good damn looking to write that quote, Mike.
You're right.
I'm
too pretty.
Too damn pretty.
I don't know if you're aware, Josh is the funniest person he knows.
That is true, though. I mean, that's true. I make myself laugh more than any stand-up comic can. I am the funniest person I know. Well, I mean, people not find me might not find me all that way.
Yeah, but mostly when you're drunk. Another fun Alec fact for everyone out there about Josh is his degree is in philosophy. Right. So I was kind of hoping he'd take it to task a little bit more on this, but he's mostly just been fanboying on you. But you've got everything right. I mean, I'm a history – my degree's in history. Josh is in philosophy. We look at your thing, and trust me, we're petty men, sir. We are petty men. When we fanboy on you like this, it's because you deserve it.
Well, thanks. It's true.
It's absolutely the best job in the world, being able to write something, you know, write what you really want to say and have it be sort of like under the radar enough that you can get away with it.
I think the industry you're in and the way you write and how you collaborate with authors, you're probably the most nuanced social critic out there right now.
Thanks. It's like I can't understand why everybody isn't writing a comic book, because it gives you that visual dimension that you don't have if you're writing essays and whatnot. And yet you don't, you know, it's not like writing for TV or movies where because there's a $50 million budget, someone's looking over your shoulder constantly trying to make it, you know, give it more fan service.
Some of us are drunk morons, sir.
Yeah.
That's our excuse.
Some of us are only halfway there.
Yeah. What other questions do we have? This is such a rare opportunity to have such a good writer. I love the fact that the Great Gazoo is pretty much just a gamekeeper, a game warden, if you will, keeping us alive on our own planet. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I actually think that would be a good idea. I would welcome the Great Gazoo.
I, for one, welcome our new overlords.
Yeah, totally. It's like we actually kind of need some adult supervision.
Well, name a couple other Hanna-Barbera figures that you would like to get your hands on that you haven't yet.
I think it would be really cool to do a Jetson series.
Ooh.
I know that Jim Palmiotti and Amanda Connor already did, and they did it very
well. And it was good.
Yeah, but I would love to do the Jetsons. Also, you know, I think maybe Space Ghost.
Ooh.
Do you have any plans for the Herculoids?
Oh, my God, I didn't even think about the Herculoids, but yeah. I would love the Herculoids.
One of my favorite Herculoids of all time, yeah.
I was a big Touche Turtle guy, so.
Thank you.
Get a Touche Turtle comic book going for me, will you? I don't even know where you'd go with him.
Or a Hong Kong Fooey.
Hong Kong Fooey had a pretty good one as a team up with Black Lightning. That was one of my favorites, not because it had much social commentary. As a matter of fact, it didn't have much social commentary, but it was such a great throwback to the old two-in-ones where you'd have two disparate superheroes teaming up for the first time, feeling each other out. It was just a great – that one was done pretty well, but I'd love to see your take on it too.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think I'll get the chance to do any of them because DC's lost the licensing for the Hanna-Barbera properties.
That probably happened after the Suicide Squad Banana Splits, which I loved. I'm in the minority on that one.
Batman Elmer Fudd was pretty awesome too.
Oh, that was great. There were some great ones.
There was a lot of good ones that came out of the both the Hanna-Barbera and the Looney Tunes crossover. I'd really like to see more of that sort of like we dare this to be good type of storytelling.
Yeah, so much of this really could have just been shite, and almost everybody took it really seriously.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. It's like you throw down the gauntlet, and it's like it makes you even more determined to turn, you know, like a Porky Pig Lex Luthor crossover into like the best story it can be, because you realize that the expectations are for you to fail.
Yeah, I'm gonna pinch off for a second here. The Eisners, for you personally, and what's your sense for the rest of the industry? How seriously do people in your industry take the Eisners?
I don't know how seriously anyone else takes it. I take them pretty seriously, because to me, it's like I describe myself as an Eisner losing writer. But to me, what that means is that I am, you know, I'm seen as being good, but not popular yet. And then when your eyes are winning, it's like that means you're good and popular. So I think it is sort of a benchmark.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, Tom King, he's doing some great stuff. Honestly, I think you should have written for writing for you should have gotten the Eisner for the writing for Flintstones, hands down. And I was glad that that came up for – that was up for total of three, right, in 2018. So,
yeah. Three Eisner, which I was super happy about because it's like you never thought in a million years that you would have ever heard the words the Flintstones nominated for three Eisners. But, yeah, it was very gratifying to me. And to me, it was just sort of – it was nice to know that, you know, maybe I'm not very well known yet. Like I'm not as well known as Tom King or Marjorie Liu in the industry.
Yeah.
But it's nice to be acknowledged as being good in the same company as a quality of writer.
Seeing that DC Comics is owned by Warner Brothers, I would really, really like you to write Pinky in the Brain versus Monsieur Mala in the Brain.
Wow.
That's a deep cut.
It's a deep cut because you love gorillas.
The title of that comic has to be The Meeting of the Minds.
Uh-huh.
We got it already.
This thing practically writes itself, sir.
Except mostly it's you writing it and us just standing around.
Drinking.
Mostly drinking.
Mostly drinking.
Mostly drinking.
Sounds good.
All right. Yeah, I don't want to keep you too much longer. We told you this would take about an hour, and it's been about that. Tell us about some of the things that you have upcoming that you're excited about, sir.
Oh, okay. Well, I've got obviously Second Coming, which I'm really happy with. And I think it's going to be really good, and I can't wait for people to actually read it. And
a lot of positive buzz, and, of course, the backlash against that one, but a lot of positive buzz so far from our side.
Great. Yeah. I just want it to be at a point where people aren't getting what they know about it from Fox News. And also I'm writing a comic for Ahoy called Billionaire Island, which I'm using some of the storylines I didn't get to use in Prez because it was canceled after six issues. But it's about this artificial island in the Gulf of Mexico. That's like sort of a home for billionaires. It's like a tax haven / sort of, libertarian dystopia for billionaires who are trying to escape the end of the world.
And
that should come out in like late 2019, early 2020.
And you said it's by Ahoy Comics?
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but I've done some writing for them. I did like a couple of their Edgar Allan Poe Snifter of Terror like comic books.
Snifter of Terror is awesome.
Yeah. I did like a Count Chocula fan fiction piece in one. Well, you know, Count... I had to call him the Marquis de Coco because I couldn't use Count Chocula. But it's sort of a Count Chocula origin story.
That is fantastic.
One harlot broken under wreck.
And I got like a Frankenberry story coming
That's not the right count.
Yeah, different count.
Fine. I mixed up my counts. I can't count.
That's available on Comixology, by the way, for our listeners.
What, yeah. Snifter of
Horror, I think. Oh, no, Terror.
Snifter of Terror.
Yes. Well, what do you do with Frankenberry?
Huh?
What do you do with Frankenberry? You just said you had
Frankenberry origin story about how he was basically betrayed to General Mills, who killed him and reanimated him like Frankenstein.
Wow. Yeah, the worst of all artificial flavors, I might add.
Yeah.
So he's actually the monster and the Frankenberry is the doctor. I hate myself for thinking that's funny, but it's funny.
I've loved working with them before, so I'm really excited to do the Billionaire Island series with them.
I'm wondering what a libertarian dystopia looks like. I know a lot of dystopias out there, but I never really thought about how a libertarian dystopia would play out.
Well, let me give you a couple of examples of what's going on this island. They have like a restaurant that only serves like endangered species.
Delicious.
It's called Natural Selections.
Jesus Christ.
they serve like red tarantula tacos. Or rhino pasties. And then there's also a movie studio that hired like all the guys disgraced by the Me Too movement. So like you could see like a movie starring like Louis C.K. and Steven Seagal made by, and it's literally called Don't Give a Shit Studios.
They should just be up on stage touching each other inappropriately.
Yeah, there's actually like a Harvey Weinstein character. Obviously, I can't call him Harvey Weinstein because he's not, you know, I can't really directly base him on Harvey Weinstein for legal reasons. But there's a character who's like one of the key members of the island who just walks around in a bathrobe all the time.
So, Tom, you're in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was about to say thanks for the walk-on part there, buddy. Well, really, I just can't thank you enough for we've taken up way too much of your time. I can't thank you enough for being on tonight. And thanks for telling us about your upcoming stuff. Anybody have any last words or questions for our good friend Mark?
Yeah, I just want to be a guy who thanks you for coming on. It's been great having you. And I have to say, you're welcome to join us any Monday. Come back.
Oh, well, thanks, guys. I'd be happy to.
Is he my replacement?
He's your replacement, Tom, yeah.
God, we would love for him to be your replacement, Tom.
I would love to be my replacement.
I've been wearing my Flintstones tie just for this moment.
Are you going to be at any Comic-Cons in the near future?
Yeah, I'm doing Emerald City in Seattle in a couple weeks. And then I'm also doing San Diego in July.
The big show, buddy.
Big show, yeah.
You need porters or hangers on, just let us know.
Yeah. I need someone to carry my litter, my sedan.
If you think for a fucking second we wouldn't do that, you are fucking wrong.
4 badges to SDCC, and I will build that litter myself.
Oh, that's 100% guaranteed we'd build that litter, sir.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is like a sort of a fun fact, but I once traded a San Diego Comic-Con badge pass for a marriage. Like I got this friend of mine who happens to also be a licensed minister a San Diego Comic-Con badge, and in exchange they agreed to perform a wedding for me if I ever got married. So when I did get married, I called them on the favor, and so I got married for the cost of a Comic-Con. Well, it wasn't, I didn't have to pay for it. I got married.
We got two ministers right here. Three ministers right here.
I have performed 2 weddings.
I'm up to like 8 now.
Wow. I stood in for 1, and the minister ran at the last second. I was the concierge in a hotel. Got the minister license just in case that fucker didn't make it, and he got in like the last second.
LT actually married myself and my wife, and we are still together.
Truth.
There you go. It's proof.
I bet you were near at one point where Mike got married. Would you take that bet, sir?
Yeah.
They'll take that bet. He got married on the ship at Treasure Island in Las Vegas.
No, yeah, that's a recipe for failure.
Yeah.
It was.
He did it in full pirate garb.
So did my wife.
Yeah.
So was I.
Did they fire the cannons for you?
No. They did not. And we tried to get Josh to swing down out of the crow's nest, but because of insurance, they wouldn't let us do it. But we did get married on the hottest day of July. On record, yeah.
Pretty much ever.
We tried to – LT must have lost about 20 pounds in water weight because of that leather hat.
It was a leather hat and a corduroy jacket I was wearing. I looked good.
I made more money that day taking pictures with tourists as a pirate than I did gambling.
Woo-hoo.
Well, I hope your marriage never walks the plank.
Ooh, oh, thank you, son.
I was going to say, I'm so old, my wife knows that she can outlast me. She doesn't want to just settle on half, so she'll just wait and get it all.
Till you die, motherfucker.
Everything boils down to math.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm screwed.
Yeah.
You are screwed.
You are.
All right, well, thanks again for joining us, Mark, and we'll hopefully talk to you again in the future.
That'd be great. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome.
We would like to thank everybody for listening, and please consider joining our Patreon-only page, patreon.com/thelongboxguys, where for just 25 cents a week, you get an extra podcast with us talking about the greatest of all time in a different geeky subject. We'd also like to thank Kirby Crackle for providing our geek rock music every week. You can check them out at kirbycracklemusic.com. In addition, we love the folks over at geekorthodox.com who provide just all kinds of great geeky stuff. If you're shopping for the nerd in your life, please consider geekorthodox.com. We want to thank our official dodgeball team, Category 5. You can go over to Category 5 Dodgeball Team on Facebook and check them out. They are in a meme war with some other dodgeball teams. Of course, we always love our fellow podcasters. We hope the Mr. Nola Nerd from the Nola Nerd Couple gets well soon. And of course, Seth Myers and the crew over at Who's Next Gaming. Go check out whosnextgaming.com to get links to all their different podcasts and videos. And once again, thank you to Mark Russell for joining us today. It was amazing having an Eisner-nominated comic book writer on our podcast. We really appreciate it. And thanks to all you folks for listening. We love you guys, and we will see you next week.
Mark, you don't have to hang up right now. I just wanted to thank you one more time. We're going to do a little
our advertisements.
Yeah, our advertisements, everything that you don't have to sit through. But, man, sure. It really was. You're one of the – I mean, everyone who's ever been on this, we've been a fan of. But we've been talking about you for like a year.
Well, awesome. No, longer.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Hey, stop it. I'm trying not to suck his dick too hard here. Fuck off.
I am dislocating my jaw, so I'll just say.
Like a cobra.
Cobras do that?
Somebody does.
Suck dick.
They do when they suck my dick.
See?
Nice. Nice, sir. All right.
That's a direct quote. What's going on?
Are you kidding? That's our new tagline.
They do when they suck my dick.
They do when they suck my dick.
When did you start day drinking today?
I did not start day drinking today. I actually worked at home all day.
You've been day drinking.
Yeah.
What's the point of working from home if you're not day drinking?
The day drinking is the best thing about being a comic book writer.
Wow, we're getting so much insider information already.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.